Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk about the history of bodybuilding, and we also talk, of course, to the legends of bodybuilding themselves. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum, who we talked to last week, and we were just catching up with Jerry. This is the first time we've talked to him in 2020, and we were talking last week about how he was getting along with this coronavirus and how he was training at home. And today we continue that discussion. Today we're talking a little bit more about the training methods, which I thought was really interesting because Jerry is so well versed in clinical experience, and he has all these studies in front of him that he puts into his Applied Metabolic newsletter, which is available every month for only $10. And it's like a 45-50 page report. So Jerry knows, of course, practical experience because he's been training for over 50 years himself. And he also has all these clinical trials. So we talked about the type of training that's best for building muscle mass. We kind of got into the discussion last week. And is it heavy training or is it light training, more volume? So this is really interesting. We're going to talk about that again. And then we talked again more about our iconic bodybuilding photos. And of course, this is a podcast, so you guys can't see it. So I'm going to post some of these photos that we talk about. I'm going to post them on bodybuildinglegendshow.com. So if you go to the website, it'll be right up there. You can click on that and check out what I think are some of the most iconic bodybuilding photos that have stood the test of time. And I'm sure a lot of you guys will agree with me on my selection. And then you can also email me if you want and give me your choices for the most iconic bodybuilding photos or your most favorite bodybuilding photos. And of course, my email address is naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn body fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com, and they will work with anybody in the continental United States. Just tell them that you heard your ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation, and they will also give you 20% off your first order. All right, at the end of the podcast today, I'm going to read a little excerpt. This is from the book Pumping Iron, but it's not the original book. It's the revised edition that came out after 1980, and seeing how we are already, believe it or not, 40 years past the 1980 Mr. Olympia, the most controversial Mr. Olympia ever, Charles Gaines, at the end of the book, writes a little bit about Arnold and his thoughts of the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which actually Charles Gaines was not at, but his partner, George Butler, was there taking pictures. So I thought it was interesting. It's a few pages long, but if you guys are interested in the 1980 Mr. Olympia and you've never heard this, this is really, really interesting. And of course, Charles Gaines, one of the best writers ever to write about the sport of bodybuilding. All right. I did get a email on our Apple podcast. So if you guys listen to us, please go to Apple iTunes and you can leave a review. So if you want to give us a 5-star rating and also leave a review, that would really be great. We are getting some good reviews. So this one his name is C. Tasca Jr. And he left it on the end of April. And his comment was outstanding and entertaining. The best bodybuilding podcast on the web. John combines an uncanny knowledge of bodybuilding history, incredible personal experience being a top-tier competitive bodybuilder, and finally, an intoxicating love for the sport. I eagerly look forward to the next week's episode. If you love bodybuilding, it's impossible to not love this podcast. Truly inspiring and legendary in its own right. Wow, what a great review. Thank you for leaving that. C. Tasca Jr. And like I said, if you guys go to iTunes and give us a review, and right now we got a 4.6 out of 5, so we got to get that up. But we got 85 ratings. So if you can go on there and do me a favor and leave a review, that would be awesome. All right. And if you ever want to send me an email, just go to naturalolympia@gmail.com and send that to me directly, and I'll read your review on the air. All right. Hope you guys are doing good out there with this coronavirus thing. I know the gyms are still not open up. They were supposed to open up out here in Florida on, I think, May 8th. And now the governor just had a meeting last week, or a press conference, I should say. And he said that the gyms are no longer now in tier number one. So we will not be opening up on May 8th. And I don't know when they'll be opening up. I know there's protests going on all over the country and people are sick of being inside. So we'll see what happens. Maybe they'll change it and open it up sometime this month. And I know it's very frustrating for a lot of people because we all want to get back to the gym. It's been over, I think, a month and a half now, probably going on 2 months, because I think it started around the middle of March. So yeah, we're headed into 2 months already with no training. So I know people are going crazy. A lot of people are training in their garages or doing home workouts, which just isn't the same, let's face it. So hopefully we'll be able to get back to normal. The food stuff is pretty good. I know eggs are back, but I think now we're going to have a meat shortage. So that's going to be happening for a while. And I don't know what's happening with the competition scene. I know all the contests for the near future have been canceled. Even some of these national contests. I think I just saw the USA Championship, the NPC USA, is postponed till December, which is crazy. That's usually at the end of July every year in Las Vegas. So they're hoping they can do that in December. But a lot of these contests, especially the local shows, they're postponing it till next year. They're just not going to have a contest this year. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Mr. Olympia. If they have to skip the Mr. Olympia for a year, that would be really crazy. Unless they just want to hold it without a crowd, sort of like they did at the Arnold Classic. But I don't think they're going to be able to hold an expo unless this really clears up. And if they don't hold the expo and they don't have any money to pay the competitors, because that's where the money comes from, I don't know what they're going to do. So we'll just have to stay tuned and see what happens. All right, that's all I got for our opening. So here is our interview with Jerry Branham. This is part two, where we talk about the best type of training to build muscle. And we also talk about the most iconic bodybuilding pictures in the history of bodybuilding. Here we go. I just got to believe that a lot of these young kids in the gym are listening to videos like this, because I see these young kids in the gym. I'm not kidding. These guys are lifting 10 to 15 pound dumbbells. I'm looking at, like, what are they?
How old are these guys?
Like 25, you know?
They're wasting their time.
I mean, they're in the prime of their life, and they're doing, like, these really light, you know, dumb, like 10 to 15 pounds. I'm like, what are they doing? They got to be watching the dumbest YouTube videos. And I came across this guy's video, and I'm like, I'll bet they're listening to this guy. You know, just lift light weights, a lot of reps. But they're not training to failure, because they weren't training hard at all. They're hardly training at all, you know?
You know what happens to those guys? After about a year, when they haven't put in any muscle, they say, well, I guess I'm not cut out for this stuff.
Right. They quit. right.
They never gave it a shot.
But I remember when I was young and I was in my 20s and we read the magazines. I mean, it was like you used the basic exercises, 6 to 10 reps. I was even going 6 to 8 reps. I was really trying to go heavy. And my whole point was I wanted to just get stronger. So the more weight I could use for that 6 to 8 reps, I knew the bigger I was going to get. If I'm benching 225 for 8 reps and I get up to 275 for 8 reps, obviously I'm going to be bigger, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the way I train, too.
Yeah.
Like I say, there's no way around it.
Right.
You have to lift the – and let me tell you, those YouTube videos, man, I never fail to be surprised when I'm looking at some of the advice – that's being given out.
I know.
I watched a bunch of them when the gym first closed. The first thing I did was go on YouTube and look at these things about how to train at home without any equipment, because I didn't have any. Yeah. I wanted to get some ideas. When I saw the exercises they're giving out, I actually literally sat here and burst out laughing. They were doing this stuff where they, like, one arm like this and they go in the air. Ridiculous garbage.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, where do these guys come off thinking that they're experts?
I know.
Anybody,
everybody's an expert.
I mean, and but the biggest shock came when my eyes went down and I looked at how many people had seen. Some of these people had 3 million views, John. And I'm thinking, my God, if these people take the advice of these guys, they're either going to get hurt, or they're certainly not going to keep in shape doing these dumb, stupid exercises.
Right.
I mean, one video says, a great exercise for the – was one guy who was telling how to get six-pack abs. And he starts out by – remember the old hanging leg raise, right?
Yeah.
You know, you bring your legs – I did that as a kid. He says this is one of the greatest – it works all the abs, lower, upper – you know, then the next video, the guy says, this is one of the worst ab exercises. It's all hip flexor. It doesn't work your abs at all. So somebody watching those videos walks away, you know, like their head is spinning, which is the truth. I mean, is it bad? Is it good? What should I do?
Right.
Those videos are no help at all.
No, you know? No.
And I'm not trying to put a halo over my head. I put out videos where I'm talking like real hard science and you know, really good stuff based on my experience. When people can get benefit, what do I get? I get 1,000 views.
I know.
Some 20-year-old schmuck who doesn't know his ass from his elbow, right. He's getting 2 million views, you know?
I know.
I used to get mad years ago when Rich Piana, he would put it out in a video. I'd put out a video. I'd get, 200 views the next day. He'd have 25,000.
And I
looked at his video, and he's sitting there, you know, and he's saying, oh, well, have a motherfucking day. Who is watching this shit?
Right.
This guy's awesome. As time went on, though, I got to think he's not a bad guy. I met him. You know, I don't want to put him down or anything like that. But, you know, I couldn't figure out why he was so popular. Of course, I overlooked the fact that this guy's sitting there with the tattoos all over him, with these like 29-inch arms,
right,
puffed from the stuff he's injecting.
Right.
That's part I overlooked.
It's
funny.
Yeah.
It took a while for it to dawn on me. Wait a minute. They're not looking at him for his information.
They just look at the image.
I thought back to myself. I said, and then I heard him say in one of his videos, he said that the people who watch his videos, he did some sort of marketing thing. They were between 14 and 18 years old. And I said, now I understand.
Yeah.
Because I said to myself, if I was 14 and they had the internet back then, which they didn't, and this guy was on the video, I'd look at him. Remember, I wanted to be big. I look at this guy with those gigantic shoulders and arms, big, huge guy. Hell yeah, I'd watch his videos.
Right, right.
Yeah, watch him. And right. I realized all these millions of people are kids.
Yeah.
That's watching his videos. Because to adults, and I confirmed this, by the way, because I asked people. Adults found him repulsive.
Yeah.
Because every third word was a curse word.
Right.
Fuck that. Motherfucker.
Right. You know,
hey, how's your balls hanging? Who the fuck wants to hear that? I mean, the average adult with a brain would just turn the guy off in 2 seconds.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Kids love it. Because he's acting like a street guy.
Yeah.
He's a big, strong. Oh, I want to be a tough guy like Rich Piana.
Right,
oh, yeah.
Right.
He doesn't care what anyone thinks. I like that.
Right.
That's the way ages think.
Yeah,
see?
Yeah, yeah.
So after that, I never took it personal again when I realized that. You know, because I'm never going to look like Rich Piana or what I want to. Especially now. But, I mean, even back then, you know.
But talk about the heavyweights, too. I mean, we said, you know, we know this works because if you go, like you're just talking about Bill Pearl, look how heavy Bill Pearl used to train. Look how heavy Reg Park used to train. And then you can go through every generation of bodybuilders from, like, even John Grimmick, if you want to go back that far. Bill Pearl, Reg Park, Arnold, Sergio trained real heavy at one time, you know. Franco, of course. And then, you know, you got Dorian. And then Lee Haney trained pretty heavy for a while, you know, when he was building up. So I think everybody, in order to get big, you got to train heavy. You got to increase the weight, and that's what's going to build the muscle. And, of course, you know, then you talk about Ronnie and Dorian. Those guys train real – Kevin Lavrone trained real heavy.
Well, remember when I was talking about earlier, I was saying that the older you get, the quicker the muscle disappears. If you've been working out regularly like me and you suddenly stop with no exercise, for some reason the muscles shrink like day by day. Well, when you're younger, let's say in your 20s, and you lift heavy weights like you're talking about, this is a really good thing. Like guys like Reg and Bill Pearl, they can lay off, John, for 6 months and hardly show any change at all. Because I remember doing that.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever laid off 6 months, but I remember taking – in my 20s, I remember going back to – I didn't train for 3 months, and I lost muscle definition for sure, you know. I didn't get fat, but I didn't have the definition. – But I remember my muscles only they shrank, but not that much.
Right.
Not that much. If I did that today, go 3 months without, I'd have no muscle left at all.
Yeah.
And why was that? Because my normal training back then was heavy weight. When you lift heavier weight, you develop real muscle.
Yeah.
The muscle stays longer. In other words, you don't just build a muscle. You build a type of muscle that's long lasting. You know, I'm not saying everyone should take 6 months off. What I'm saying is that I remember reading John Grimmick, the only man to win the Mr. America twice. I mean, you know John Grimmick.
Yeah, sure.
So, I remember reading an article where he says he took a year off. A year. And he said he hardly noticed anything. He says he lost, because remember, he was also an Olympic weightlifter. He lost strength, he said, but the muscle size hardly changed. I never forgot. Yeah. And I remember reading, I was a kid when I read that, and I'm thinking, how could you take a year off and you know, not lose much muscle? I didn't understand that. I didn't realize that he was a really strong guy,
yeah.
And he had some real muscle.
Right.
Another example, Steve Reeves. Remember Steve Reeves and Hercules?
Yeah.
Would you say, I mean, he had a pretty good physique, right?
Great physique,
would
you say, yeah.
Did you know that Steve Reeves, he said this himself. When he was doing that movie, he only trained 1 month out of the year.
Wow.
1 month out of the entire year. When I read that, I was stunned because I remember he looked great.
Yeah.
All right. He didn't look like the guy said. He had he inspired millions.
Yeah, he inspired millions. I was going to say, he inspired millions of people.
That physique he had, my God, you know yeah. what I mean? And when I found that, I heard him say it himself. I trained 1 month out of the year for that. I said, my God, the genetics this guy must have
yeah.
to retain that physique with 1 month of training.
Right.
And I'm guessing, he didn't say, but I'm guessing that the monthly train was probably leading up to the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he, you know, he looked good. He had abs and stuff. And I'm thinking he trained only for that movie. And he looked that good 1 month.
Wow.
Gee, that makes you really realize the importance of genetics and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Never do that. I can never do that. Never.
Well, I had hernia surgery last year, and I had to take off 6 weeks. I couldn't do anything. The doctor told me, don't do nothing, not even lay.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to get smaller. I didn't lose hardly anything.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, the heavy weight, I'm telling you, retains the muscle.
Right.
You know, and like I say, I believe that even with the lightweight to failure, even if you could build muscle, I don't think it would last if you quit training. I think you'd shrink down to nothing because you haven't built strength.
Right.
There's something about building strength that retains muscle. I'm not really – maybe it's the neuromuscular involvement.
Yeah.
I'm not
yeah.
sure. But there's something about building strength that retains muscle. If you don't build strength along with muscle, the muscle is very, very ephemeral. It'll disappear when you stop training.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I think that's the key.
Yeah. Yeah, I developed a system a couple of years ago. I wrote a book about it. I call it the MP6 workout. The M stands for mass. The P stands for power. So each cycle lasts 6 weeks. So I have a 6-week cycle for power where I'm actually trying to increase my strength. Then I go into another cycle for mass. I use the same workout, same exercises, and then I base my weights on the mass cycle based on what I did with the power cycle.
You know? Okay.
And then I try to increase the weights with the mass cycle too. So the whole point is that I can do more weight for that 6 to 12 reps, you know, the hypertrophy reps. I can eventually use more weight because I figured in order to get stronger on the exercises, you got to really specifically train for power. So right. I'll do a power cycle. I'm not doing like 1 to 3 reps. I'm doing like 4 to 6 reps or 3 to 5 reps. You know, maybe on the assistance exercises, the isolation movements, I might even do like 5 to 7 reps, you know, like laterals right. and stuff like that. Right. So I'm not doing like a powerlifting routine, but I am training with heavier weights. And then right. when I go to the mass cycle, I can use more weight for the higher reps.
Let me ask you this. When you did the power part of that training, did you increase the velocity of the movement a little bit? You know, like, in other words, move the weight a little faster than
yeah.
you normally
would? Yeah, I always try to do that too. Yeah.
But to develop muscle power requires greater velocity.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking to develop muscle power, you have to move the weight. I'm not saying that you have to live light, but even with the heavyweight, you have to move it a little faster than
right.
you normally would.
Right.
Keeping the weight control, but it still has to be – that's how you develop muscle power.
Okay, yeah. I remember yeah. Franco used to train like that. Franco used to train, like push it really fast, you know.
It develops a lot of power.
Yeah.
And that's the way athletes train if they put muscle power. You got to, you know, not lifting light necessarily, but You know, move the weight as fast as you can while keeping it under control. You got to keep the weight under. You can't do it. It's going to snap your joint out.
Right. You know? But you're trying to accelerate through the movement, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I shot some videos for my YouTube channel, and I was surprised when I saw the videos. Like, I was doing a 140-pound one-arm dumbbell row.
Wow.
When I saw the video, I was like, wow, it's moving really fast. But I remember when I was doing the workout, it felt heavy. But when I saw the video, it looks light because I'm moving it really fast, you know. But that's because of what you're saying. It's because of the acceleration, the power.
But that was a power. You were doing a power movement, too.
Right.
It's no doubt. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jerry, let me go over some of these pictures, and I'll get your comments on them.
Okay.
All right, the one picture I had that I think is an iconic picture. It's not actually on stage. It's the one where Arnold's walking up the stairs at the 1974 Mr. Olympia.
I remember that one.
Yeah. What is it about that picture that makes it such a great picture? I mean, everybody sees that picture, so it's like, wow, that's a great picture.
Is that the one taken from the back?
No, he's walking up the stairs. He's got one leg up.
Yeah.
And I think he's walking on the stage or he's walking backstage. I'm not really sure. He's just totally relaxed, but he looks magnificent.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because Arnold was in, you know, peak shape and you got him in a kind of semi-relaxed position where he's, you know, right before he poses.
Totally relaxed, yeah.
Yeah, and you could see the type of muscle mass the man developed. It was, you know, just look at the guy walking around like that, you know, it's very impressive.
Yeah. Can you imagine having a physique walking around like that? That's inconceivable.
Well, I told you the story, I've told this 100 times about, you know, when we went down to the nude beach, me, Arnold, and
And
I'll never forget that because, you know, there was one about 2 weeks before the 74 Olympia, and Arnold was in Olympia shape, and these people had never, forget about Arnold, they'd never seen a bodybuilder. And here's Arnold, can you imagine the best bodybuilder in the world is there on the beach? I must have had, 2,000 eyes on him. Everybody on the beach stopped what they were doing. I'll never forget that. We're staring at him. They had never seen anything like it.
Right.
I'll always remember that. It was something to behold.
Right.
Arnold, he loved it. You know, he likes the attention.
Yeah.
Even though he was naked, he didn't care.
Yeah.
He didn't care.
It's funny, you know, because now they always talk about who was the greatest bodybuilder ever. A lot of people say Ronnie Coleman. Yeah. You know, a lot of people say Jay Cutler, a lot of people say Dorian. But I don't know, for me, a lot of people say Lee Haney. I got to mention Lee Haney because, of course. But for me, I don't know. Like, if I see a picture of Arnold from, like, 1973, 74 that I never saw before, I feel like I'm a 13-year-old kid again. I'm like, oh, my God, look at that. You know, I feel like I'm a kid. Like, it just blows me away, you know.
All those guys are great, but I also lean towards Arnold as being the greatest.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's not just the bodybuilding, it's what he achieved also. You know, he spread the word about bodybuilding. He got people interested. I mean, not to put down the other guys, but nobody ever did what Arnold did.
No.
I give Arnold, Joe Weider popularized, you could say Joe Weider popularized bodybuilding among bodybuilders, you know, with his magazines, you know. But I think Arnold's the one who got it, popularized it among, like, let's say, the public to the extent where people would want to start working out, you know. Yeah. They want to. Well, maybe I can get a physique too, you know. I think Arnold was largely responsible for that.
Oh, so yeah.
If you draw a line under all of it, I have to say that Arnold is. I still say he's the greatest bodybuilder ever. And I know what you're talking about. Though some of those, I still see some pictures every so often that I haven't seen of Arnold, and you know when he was at his peak. And I knew the guy. I mean, I saw him all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm just amazed that, you know, it's, I mean, I know they have Photoshop and all those tricks they have today, but these were not Photoshop pictures. And the thickness and mass of his muscles was just amazing. I mean, just amazing.
And it's just the shape of his body. I mean, they talk about aesthetic bodybuilders like Serge Nubre or Frank Zane, you know, but he's not always considered an aesthetic bodybuilder. But he had great muscle shape because everything just flowed together, you know.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he had. You know, I mean, he never had any great abs.
No.
But his abs were passable.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't something you'd say, well, the man has had really bad abs. They were passable. So he had everything together. I mean, of course, his arms were just nobody could touch those things.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, like this picture I'm talking about, he's totally relaxed, just walking up the stairs. And I think that's what, I mean, to me, that picture blows away all these other pictures of all these bodybuilders who are standing on stage all tensed up or hitting a pose. That picture where he's just walking up the stairs, that's always been like one of my favorite pictures in bodybuilding.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my top three, if I were to choose the greatest of all time, this might surprise people. I mean, like I say, the guys you mentioned are all fantastic and great. Don't get me wrong. But I almost hate to say this because I didn't really like him personally. I know you know him. Sergio Oliva. I didn't like the guy personally, but I mean, I have to admit what a genetic freak he was. I remember when I first saw him in person, I was looking at his waist. He was wearing one of those shirts he used to wear, you know, shirt with the arms sticking out. And I'm thinking, my God, how does a guy get like that? How does his waist get so freaking small?
Right.
I just couldn't believe it, you know?
Right.
And another guy who, to me, was absolutely mind-boggling. You know, I think he a lot of people call him great, but I always look at him as kind of an underestimated guy, was Flex Wheeler when he was what a physique that guy had.
Yeah.
Again, some of the photos he took looked like they were like a freaking photo shoot. They didn't look like there's a shot of him where he's about to do it. I think he's like this. He's about to do a pose. I mean, the thickness of his arms and shoulders and his leg, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I don't think Heath or any of the guys match Flex the way he looked in those photos.
Right.
I think he destroyed them all. That's my personal opinion.
You know? Yeah. Well, the other picture I had in mind, one of the most iconic pictures ever was Sergio at the 72 Olympia where he's doing his famous myth pose, you know.
Well, definitely. Okay. That was Sergio's pose. Yeah. There's no question about it. Yeah, that was
It's particularly that picture, right?
Yeah.
Boyer Coast is the same thing.
But you know, the thing is, to do that pose, you have to have certain things going for yourself. First of all, you have to have a very small waist. It has to be a narrow, small waist. And you have to have broad shoulders, huge arms, huge forearms, and wide lats.
And huge legs, and big legs.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, if you don't have those, let's say, requirements or prerequisites, let's call it, you don't, because I remember trying to do that pose even when I was in my best shape and I looked like absolute crap.
Right.
I just not have the lat width or the size to get away with it. You know, Sergio Jr. is doing pretty good with that pose. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he has a lot of his father's shape. He can get away with it. But most bodybuilders who try to do that pose have not been able to do it successfully. So, I think we were talking about this once, John, how remember the Olympia where the guys came out in shadow first? They did their, you know, back in those days, you could tell. They didn't have to turn the lights on.
Right.
Frank Zane did his pose like, you knew it was Frank Zane.
Right.
Even Lee Haney, you could always tell the guys.
Yeah.
I mean, when Sergio, if he came in and did this, there'd be no doubt who
No doubt, yeah.
Even people that hardly know about bodybuilding, there's Sergio.
Right.
I mean, that was his pose.
Right.
And it'll always be his pose. I don't think anyone will ever beat them in that pose.
In that one picture, that was probably his best shape ever. So that pose and that picture at that time, Albert Busek took that picture. He just took it at the exact right time. Even the look on Sergio's face, you know, he's got that slight smirk on his face. It was just such a perfect picture.
Yeah, well, he said it was 72. Was that the one?
72, the one that he should have won.
Far and away, Sergio's best shape ever.
Yeah.
Best ever. There's no question about it. So, yes, that would definitely be an iconic picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pure Sergio. That's you could see.
I always thought that picture to me was like the picture of Ali standing over Sonny Liston.
The iconic picture,
you know, just like,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else did I have on my list here? Oh, I mentioned Haney. The Platts pose right before the 81 Olympia where he's on the beach and he's doing that most muscular pose like this with his leg out.
Yes. I think that's hanging up at Gold's Gym.
John Balick took that.
Yeah, there's a large version of this, six foot photo that hanging up in Gold's Gym.
Right.
That's a tremendous
photo. That picture's unbelievable. Yeah.
With Tom's legs.
He did a similar pose at the 81 Olympia, too.
Yeah. Well, I don't think, I don't know, but John, Do you think anyone has anyone ever equaled Tom's leg development, his thigh to this day? Has anybody of those, would you say, ever really equaled that level of development?
I'll tell you, you know, that's a good topic to talk about because these guys today, you know, when you go to contests too every once in a while, the guys today have unbelievable leg development. I always wondered what was responsible for it. It's got to be the drugs, I would think.
Yeah, a lot of it's the drugs.
Yeah, because, I mean, I went to they have the Tampa Pro out here. So that's a high-level pro show. I think it's the last pro show where the guys can qualify for the Olympia. So they'll usually get a few big names. But all the bodybuilders, like let's say they got 15, 20 bodybuilders. I'm usually sitting up close because I know the promoter. These guys come out, and I'm just shaking my head at their legs. They look like they have 30-inch legs. I'm like, if one of these guys would have been transported back into the 80s, people would freak out, you know? I mean, every one of these guys has just incredible legs.
You know, and the funny thing about it is that you know, why didn't the guys years ago all have legs like that?
Right.
And you know what the answer is the drug. The drugs are the
drugs.
It's
got to be the drugs.
It has to be the drugs because they're doing this basic. And the funny thing is, the guys years ago were more into exercise that do give you big legs, like squats. I mean, in more recent years, squats have become more or less a rarity.
Yeah, they're doing leg presses, yeah.
I mean, Yates said in a video, he never does squats. He felt they were completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
He just heavy leg presses, extensions. Paul Dillette, old friend of mine, Paul Dillette, had huge legs. Look at his pictures, gigantic. I never saw him do a single squat, not once.
Right.
And so, you know, the guys, they have bigger legs, but they're not doing the exercise that normally give you the use, other than heavy leg press.
Yeah.
So what could it be? There's only one answer, drugs.
Yeah. And nobody, I don't hear anybody doing squat workouts like Tom Platz did.
No, nobody does that. Nobody does that. I haven't seen that in years.
No.
Even when I go to Goals now these days, the only people I see doing squats are powerlifters.
Right.
I don't see any bodybuilders doing squats.
Right.
Whether they're elite or just average guys in the gym, I do squats, but I do them on a machine.
Yeah.
And I do them because I can't do the free weight because my knees are really bad. And I'm afraid. And I also have two discs out my lower back. I can't take the chance of doing free weights.
Right.
In fact, I do free weight squats in the little gym I'm training at now, you know, because that's all they have. You know, there's a squat rack. But I started to set up the bar, and I actually chickened out. I said, I haven't done freehand squats so long, I'm afraid to do them. I'm here by myself. You know, what if I break my skull on the floor? So what I did is I did the hack squats instead. I loaded up the – which was a great workout.
Yeah.
I mean, free bar, you know, hack squats. You know, that's the way Steve Reese used to do them. You know, and that's really surprised. You know, the funny thing is I can't do hack squats on the machine because of the angle. It hurts my knees.
Yeah.
But when the old-fashioned original hack squat with the barbell held under your hips, I didn't have any knee pain at all. Isn't that weird?
I'm going to try that again. I haven't done that in a long time. I'm going to try that one again.
You know what I did, though, John? I'll tell you the trick. I did it, you know, because I knew I couldn't lift a lot of weight. What I did is I did very slow controls.
Right.
I did, you know, almost like the super slow. Not that slow, but I went real slow, went up slow. I kept tremendous much muscle tension on there, and I forced myself to do a minimal 12 reps. I never got 20. I believe it. And it was so hard I couldn't do 20 reps.
Did you put your heels on a board?
No, I didn't. I looked for a board. They didn't have the board.
Huh.
I just flat footed.
Wow.
But I tried to keep my upper body. I did lean slightly forward.
Yeah.
But the trick was that tension. Real slow up and down for like 15. I'm telling you, your legs start to hurt after 8.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the 15th, if you make it that far, you put that weight down, John, you're going to feel like you did 400-pound squats. Trust me.
Wow. I'm going to try it.
The first time I did it, I had to sit down, and I shook my head. I was there by myself. I said, I can't believe how my legs feel.
Yeah.
I didn't expect this. I thought I'd get a light, like, I'll get, you know, maybe a light pump or something. But I felt it down to the bone.
Yeah, yeah.
The heart.
Wow.
You know, I like doing those things.
Yeah. But to answer your question, Jerry, I don't think anybody has approached Tom Platz's leg development.
I don't think so either.
No.
I don't think so either. You know,
I don't think anybody's created the excitement that he had about his legs. Like, you know, not today. Nothing like that.
Well, I'm talking also about, you know, the legs all the way around. I mean, remember when he used to do that bent over thing?
Yeah.
The ripped up hamstrings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the whole big picture, the combination of that leg development. Right. And his calves are pretty good. They weren't.
They're real good. Yeah.
Good. You know, I mean, you know, they weren't like Mike Monterossi's or anything, but they were, you know, they were definitely, you wouldn't say yes, weak calf.
No.
So I would say that to this day, Tom remains unchallenged as I think the best developed legs of all time.
Now we were just talking about fiber types. His was an interesting situation because I think what Tom did was he became a really good heavy squatter when he was younger, like doing 600-pound squats. And then when he got more into bodybuilding, he would still use heavy weights but with higher reps, like 50 reps with 315 or something like that, you know. So I think that was the key for him to.
It is the key. I can confirm that because I interviewed Tom once on how he developed his legs. And he told me the story. He said when he was a young kid, he sent a picture of himself. He was like, what, 12 or something?
Yeah.
He sent a photo of himself to Joe Weider.
Right? I remember you told me this, yeah.
He said, Joe Weider commented. He says, you have a nice upper body, but you need much more work on your legs. I can imagine, Tom Flats, of all people. So he goes back to the gym and he trained. I think he was somewhere in Detroit somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was a powerlifter gym. He started, like you say, lifting the heavy weights, doing the heavy squats, you know, and his legs grew, right?
Yeah.
But I remember in the answer, he says, Jerry, you know what the real key, you know what gave me the real freaky look on the legs? I said, what was that, Tom? He says, me and a training partner started fooling around one day with higher reps. We started doing like 50 rep squats, even 100 reps sometimes.
Wow.
He says, I tell you, my legs like grew like you cannot believe. So after that, just like you said, he'd take like 315 and he'd do like 50 reps with it, you know?
Yeah.
And that, believe it or not, and he did this weird kind of hack squat where he'd like throw his hips over.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what a knee crusher that was. Yeah. Oh my God. But those two exercises, I never saw anyone do hack squats like that.
No.
But I remember, I mean, those two exercises, that's what gave him the freaky look and the higher reps, you know?
Yeah.
And I tried it myself. I mean, I remember training with a guy where when we did squats, we do about six sets of squats, barbell, free squats. And at the last set, we would do as many reps as we could. I couldn't use 315, but I used 225, I remember, you know, two plates on the bar. And I remember, I actually did 100 reps with 225, right? I you know, we had like contests to see who could do the most reps. And we, you know, one day we would do 50, then 60, and this and that. So I did 100, you know. And I remember getting off there. My legs felt like rubber. But I realized that, remember, I have asthma. I was breathing so hard, John, when I finished that set, I had my asthma spray was in the locker at the top of the stairs. The locker room was on top of a long flight of stairs at Gold's Gym. And I realized my lungs were shutting down. I literally could not breathe. And I said, my God, I got to get to that spray. And I looked at, I said, my legs were buckling. I could barely walk. How am I going to get up these two flights of stairs?
Right.
I actually crawled up the stairs.
Oh, God.
I couldn't walk. I crawled up the stairs. I crawled into the locker room. Thank God I got to my locker. I took the spray. I was fine 5 minutes later.
Jeez.
You know, I'll never forget. It's the only time I ever did that. But, I mean, my God, boy, talk about – oh, aerobic work?
Yeah.
I got that from doing any kind of aerobics. and you know what the funny thing is? I swear to you, I did measure my legs, but I remember looking at my legs a couple of days, I could swear that they looked bigger. My thighs actually looked bigger. I didn't measure them, but to my naked eye, they looked bigger. I always remember that.
So now talking about fiber types, like we were just talking about, when Tom was doing like 50 reps, he's still hitting the 2B fiber types, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because he's training to failure.
Yeah, he's training to failure. Yeah. Or even, like I say, even if he comes close to failure, which he did because I watched him do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he never went to the point where he was in the bottom position and had to throw the weight off his back.
Right, right.
That would be a complete fail. But that's too dangerous to do.
Yeah.
Dealing with, you know. So what he would do is he'd stop short just of failure. When you're doing that, you're getting all the muscle fibers, all of them.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Look at his legs.
Oh, I know. Freaky. Unbelievable.
I mean, that's 2B fibers there in the flesh.
Right.
You look at legs like that unless you're hitting the 2B fibers, you know?
Right, right. I got two more photos I want to talk about. One was, Sergio with the pool stick. Remember that?
Yeah. With the arm down like this.
Was that Jimmy Caruso or Art Zeller that took that one?
Art Zeller. That was an Art Zeller. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's...
He's got the hat on. That had to be when he was winning the Olympia in the 60s, right? Late 60s.
Yeah, that was around 19... that was around 66, 67.
67 when he won his first one?
Yeah, that was around that time. Yeah. Yeah, I think that was at... a bodybuilder's house? I can't remember.
Don Peters?
Yeah, that's right. We're all there for a party, yeah. And then he was playing pool.
Yeah.
He had that little hat on, you know.
Yeah,
that classic Sergio picture also. Yeah.
Now, I heard a story. I don't know if this is true. I don't know what. I think Don Peters might have said it. I think that house was owned by a guy who was a millionaire, and he loved bodybuilders, and he let Don Peters stay there. And then there was a room where he had the one-way mirror, and he would watch the guys work out.
Well, I don't know about the one-way mirror, but the guy who owned it owned a movie thing, like you say. He was a gay guy, didn't work out himself.
Right.
And he hung out with another gay guy who was a doctor. And they used to bring up the bodybuilders would stay there and watch him and stuff like that. And, you know, they'd probably peek at him walking around naked or whatever, you know.
Right.
But according to the bodybuilders, supposedly the guys never touched him. They just got off looking at him.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah.
They didn't physically touch him. That wouldn't have gone too well, you know.
Right.
But yeah, Don Peters worked with this guy. The guy gave him a job. Don Peters was a film editor for this guy.
Yeah. He
actually, yeah.
Okay. He worked with
him. Yeah. Yeah. I think that guy passed away years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was funny situations back then. You know, I'm always suspicious of these guys, John, that hang around bodybuilders, and they don't train at all. It's obvious they don't train. They have an intense interest in bodybuilding, but they don't seem to like come on to the bodybuilders, you know, like homosexuals or anything.
Uh-huh.
But you know, I've seen these guys for years, and I always wonder about that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, one of them just passed away, and I don't want to mention his name. You know, I used to see this guy around. He's trained several top bodybuilders, including a friend of mine, Joe Antonio. Mm-hmm. I must be not Joe. What's his name? Joe, the guy who won the Mr. America.
Joe Miko?
Not Joe Miko, this other guy. I can't remember.
D'Angelo. Yeah.
Yeah. Joe D'Angelo, I knew him too. And Joe D'Angelo never, you know, he said he was a really smart guy. He never mentioned anything, but I always wondered because I used to go to contest, I'd always see this guy hanging around. He was a little short, fat guy.
Bob Gruskin.
That's it, Bob Gruskin.
Yeah, we just did a show about him.
Yeah, now, you know, I never spoke to the guy other than hello. You know, he was introduced to me by some of the guy. Hello, how you doing? Shit, just say. I never had a conversation, but I always wondered because he'd always be hanging around the guys and training them, supposedly. And I always wondered, like, what's the deal there? He obviously was never a bodybuilder.
Right.
He doesn't train himself. Why is he so interested in bodybuilding?
Yeah, we just did a show last week. We had John DeFendis on there and Jerry Scalise, and these guys were praising him, man. They just said he helped him out so much. He was like,
I hear the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard Joe DeAngelo. Joe had nothing but good things to say about
him.
He said he really helped him
just
a lot.
Just gave of his time and his knowledge and everything. Yeah,
but you're right, and I'm sure the guy was an intelligent guy. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, he was a school teacher. Yeah.
Hey, but I wonder now what was the deal for him? I mean. He didn't seem to have any real connection to bodybuilding, you know, and yet he had this intense interest in it where he would work with the guys and I can understand if he trained himself and wasn't as successful, let's say amateur or something like that, or just recreational, I could see it then.
Yeah.
But this clearly didn't train.
No, he was
just a short little fat guy.
Right.
I could never figure that out. And, you know,
He was involved in bodybuilding. He was in that. He had that magazine called Muscle Up, and I think he used to contribute to that. He used to be a photographer. And then I think when they had NABBA over in the USA, I think he was the president of that. So
okay, all right. Well, that
judge and stuff. Yeah,
I wasn't aware of that. So okay, maybe now I understand because I've seen other guys like that.
Yeah,
you know, and like I say, they don't seem to come on to the bodybuilders.
No, he wasn't gay at all. No.
You know.
Yeah,
I mean. I don't want to mention his name. We'll both get sued. But there's a guy who publishes a bodybuilding magazines like that.
Uh-huh.
At the you know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
I always used to sit with the guys, and I'd love to hang around him. But as far as I know, he never came on to any of them. You know, and I always wonder what's going on there. I never figured it, you know,
really getting out of it.
Of course, he did publish a magazine, so you could say he had interest that way. You
know? Right, right.
So, the magazine still exists too. You know, as far as I see.
Right.
So I was, it's just curious. No big deal. Hey, look, you know what? If everybody's happy, I'm happy.
These guys were very, you know, he just died on the 14th, and so we did a tribute show last week, and they were very emotional. They were like, you know, this guy helped them out, and he helped them out when they were teenagers. He never charged them any money, and he would buy them meals, and, you know, he would just help them out. And amazing, you know, just the difference he made in their lives. It was incredible.
That's great. You see, that's another thing I noticed about him. He tended to veer towards teenagers.
Yeah, yeah.
That also.
I was from Chicago, so I didn't know him that much because he was from New York. I met him once, and he did put me in a magazine. He put me in my first magazine, Muscle Up, when I was a teenager. I took second in a teenage contest, and he talked to me afterwards, and he said I had potential, and he gave me he sent me out a questionnaire, and I filled out the questionnaire, and then he made an article about it. It was a one-page article, and it was a picture of me. It was kind of a fuzzy picture. It didn't turn out that great, but he got me in my first magazine, so he was good to me. But these other guys, I mean, he really helped them with their career.
They became really fantastic bodybuilders. But I mean, it could be that maybe he veered towards the teenagers because they had the most potential. I mean,
they had the most
potential to grow and become really great. Maybe that could be his motivation too.
Yeah.
Again, I'm guessing because I don't know the guy.
Right.
I mean, I didn't know from Adam, you know, but I know that again, the one or two guys like Joe who worked with him, like you said, they said nothing but good things about him.
Yeah, yeah.
They were very respectful and very impressed by him.
Yeah. All right, my last picture, Jerry, is the Arnold side chest shot that John Bailey took at Gold's Gym with Franco in the background going, "Whoa!" Remember that one?
Yeah, oh yeah, that was Arnold had that tremendous chest shot. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I actually won my first two teenage contests as a bodybuilder by emulating that pose.
Yeah,
with Arnold.
Yeah.
I beat the other guys because I had the biggest chest. Believe it or not.
Really?
Some of the guys were a little more muscular than me, but when I turned to the side and I did that chest shot, they couldn't match it. None of the guys had chests like that.
Right.
I know how I got mine. I got mine by doing. I started training about 12, age 12. I did. Remember the old breathing squat exercise where you take deep breaths. I did that, and then you'd immediately do straight on pullovers across the bench.
Right.
I did that for the first 2 years I trained, and remember, I was only 12 years old.
Yeah.
So your bones are still flexible.
Right.
The cartilage could, actually grow.
Right.
So that I gave myself this huge chest.
Yeah. Huge rib. You had a big rib cage.
Big rib cage. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I would have had it if I didn't do that stuff.
Yeah.
And it served me well. It helped me quite a few bodybuilding contests because when I turned to the side, I'm not saying I look like Arnold by any means, you know, but I kind of had that same kind of look where you'd say, wow, this guy's got a chest.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, you definitely – Arnold is another one of the poses that it's hard to match, you know. And again, you don't see a lot of guys doing that today.
No, nobody does that pose right anymore.
And they do this kind of stuff, you know, where they're with showing their arms and shoulders.
Well, they all crunch down on the side chest now. They don't pull it up. Yeah. They don't do the lifted ribcage pose.
Yeah, why not? Why? Maybe they don't have ribcage? What's the problem with these guys? Why do you think
the guy who did that first was Robbie Robinson at the Night of the Champions, remember?
He wanted to show the serratus.
He wanted the intercostals, so he would, crumb down. But now everybody does it like that. They do, a crunching pose.
I guess they think it's more important to show that than to show a big chest is the only thing I could think
of. Yeah, nobody does that side lifted ribcage anymore.
Yeah. In some cases, I think it's because, you know, I believe in some cases, you remember Arnold had those slab pecs.
Huge
pecs. They were slabs.
Yeah.
They were slabs of beef on his chest, right?
Right.
Did that, you can see those big pecs sticking out, right?
Right.
I think another reason why these guys don't do that side chest, they don't have the pectorals.
They don't
to
have
do
that
it.
Kind of development, right?
I'm picturing my mind. Phil Heath. Phil Heath is a great body. Whoa, tremendous. Look at his pecs.
Yeah, weak.
Pectorals are not in proportion to his shoulders and all.
No.
If he tried to do his side chest, he'd look ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Because even if he had a rib cage, which I don't know whether he does or not, He doesn't have the pectorals to get away with that pose.
Right.
And he knows that. He's not a stupid guy. He knows that.
Right.
You'll never see him in a side chest pose like Arnold did.
No.
You know, Louis Ferrigno had a good side
chest pose. Yeah, I was just going to say, Lou Ferrigno had a great side chest pose.
Lou Ferrigno. And there was a guy years ago, I'm trying to remember his name. Oh, God. Oh, this guy's rib butts was so big, he used to put a glass of water on top of his chest. it's right at the tip of my tongue. Old time bodybuilder. He would do the side chest and put a glass of water sitting on top of his
chest. Mike Katz? No,
way before. Mike Katz is another guy, very big rib box, too.
Yeah.
But this is way before that. I can't remember the guy's name. But he was famous because he'd put that glass of water on top of his chest while doing the chest. And it would sit there like it was on a table. That's how big his chest is. So, you know, again, I mean, that's one of the things that I guess you could say are bygone days of posing, the side chest pose, you know.
And, I agree with you about the pullover because I started training when I was like 13, 14, and I did the same thing. I trained at home, and I always did pullovers at my chest workout, and I've got a real big rib cage.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think it makes a difference, John. I couldn't figure it out for years. In fact, I was interviewed. This guy wrote a book about squatting, believe it or not. Can't remember his name, but he mentioned me in the book because I told him about me doing breathing squats and the straight-up pull-ups. And I said something that I put about 8 inches of on my chest in a year, which was true, right?
Wow.
And the thing is I'm trying to remember what I was about to – a blank. Oh, I know what I was going to tell you. See, I couldn't figure out why did my chest grow so fast. I mean, the rib box, when I did it so young, and you too, and Arnold and Lou, all these guys did that. We all did those straight on pull.
Right.
Why is it that a guy who does it, let's say 30 years old, doesn't get the same effect?
Right.
The reason, and I've actually came across this in a science study, is what I was saying to earlier. The bones are still forming when you're young.
Cartilage, yeah.
So is the cartilage, and you can actually manipulate the cartilage and the bones where you can actually make them stick out more.
Yeah.
It's do pullovers at a young age while you're a teenager. That's the only time you could do it. You can't do it once you get to be like 20, too late.
Right.
You can't do it when you're young. You'll find, if you were to check, I guarantee you, I almost guarantee every guy that has a huge rib box, if you were to question them, I'm almost positive they'll always tell you that they did some form of pullover when they first started training.
Yeah.
Because you could do that? I didn't know I was doing that. I had no idea it had that effect. I found it out years later. But that's the truth. Because I know Arnold, because, you know, Arnold did do pullovers when he was a young guy.
Yeah.
He started right out. He did. That's, you know, that's how he got that huge rib box.
If you look at pictures of Arnold, too, when he was a teenager, he had no chest development. His chest was so flat. And it became so iconic later on. He had like. Now he's known today as like the best chest development ever.
Yeah, there's a picture of him. As a matter of fact, I think he's competing. He's 16 years old.
Yeah.
That photo of him, he doesn't even have a rib box.
No.
No pecs.
You would never think he would become what he became.
Yeah, no pecs, no rib box. It's amazing. Amazing. Yeah,
it is amazing.
I mean, you know, well, what can I say? I mean, sometimes it's like I wrote an article for my newsletter. It was about, you know, bodybuilding genetics. And I said, you know, genetics plays an important role in bodybuilding. But one thing you have to consider, you can't look at a guy who's just starting out and totally predict what he's going to look like after a couple of years of training. And I remember using Larry Scott as an example, the first winner of the first two Olympia. Larry Scott was a skinny guy with no muscle at all, by his own admission, right? Nothing, right? What he did is he packed on muscle. Certain genetic things he couldn't change, like his narrow shoulders,
right,
his lack of back width. But what he did is he emphasized the things that he could really change, his superlative shoulders and arms. So still some of the best in bodybuilding history, like that photo I held up. I mean, he concentrated on that. But my point is, looking at him when he first started, or even when he first, his title, when he first title, there's a photo of him doing a double ump shot. I think he won the Mr. Iowa or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he had beautiful bicep. He had that famous bicep shape, but his arms were like 16 inches. They looked tiny.
Yeah.
You know, you never would have imagined that this guy could get those Mr. Olympia arms that he eventually got.
Right.
So my point being that, sure, genetics are important, but don't look at yourself when you're first starting out and say, and look at a Mr. Olympia or one of these, you know, look at you or a top bodybuilder and say, well, I can never look like John Hansen. I mean, I just don't have – you can't do that. Right. You'll never know In other words, you'll never know how cold the water is unless you step into the water.
Right,
the way of looking at it, you know what I mean?
Right.
And even if you don't have, this is another point I made in that article, even if you don't have the great genetics like Larry Scott, there's always things that you have that you could key in on and put yourself up there. Like, let's say that you can't get big, right? What do? You concentrate on shape and definition. Example, Frank Zane. Frank Zane knew he could never be 225.
Right.
He told me once he was fat at 205.
Right.
205 he was fat.
Right.
So he competed at 180. I think the heaviest he ever was 190 in the show. He averaged about 180 to 185 in the show. But what was he? Hard as a rock.
Right.
Little tiny waist. You know, beautiful definition. You know what I mean? Concentrated on posing to make himself look, present himself. You know what I mean? The man never had huge arms, but you didn't even notice it.
Right.
He'd do the shots like this or the tricep shot. You wouldn't even notice it. He'd never display himself. That's the key to success. So, I'm saying genetics is definitely important, but I don't think it's the be-all and end-all of everything. I don't think a guy who thinks he has bad genetics should, you know, quit bodybuilding and say it's not for me. No, I totally disagree with that.
Right.
Completely. Right. I'm sorry. I read that all the time.
Yeah.
I read these articles and I see video. Well, if you don't have your genetics, you'll never be a top bodybuilder.
Right.
Ah, bullshit.
Right.
I remember there was a bodybuilder years ago. He competed in the AU America. He was from Connecticut. Ken Passarello, I think
his
name was.
Yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yep.
Did you ever see some photos of him when he started?
Yeah. He was fat, wasn't he?
450 pounds.
Wow.
That is a freaking house.
I didn't know he was that heavy.
This guy had like six jaws.
Wow.
Rip jaws. Forget the shark.
Wow. Look,
this guy was fat. And you look at this guy and you say, you know, what? He's going to start bodybuilding?
Right.
You got kidding. This guy doesn't have a chance. This guy can get nowhere in bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, took him years, but he wound up entering the AU Mr. America, got rid of every bit of fat. And here's the big shocker of all. When they did fat testing at that contest, he showed the lowest body fat level of any competitor.
Really? Wow.
How's that for a success story? You know what I mean? I remember, you remember Bill Reynolds from Bill Reynolds once took me in his office, up at the Weider office. He showed me, he says, I want to show you some photos. He took out these 8x10s of this woman, and she was a little short, stout, fat woman, big, giant, wide hips. You know, the big giant butt and everything. And I said, and he says to me, do you think she could ever be a bodybuilder, Jerry? And I looked at him and I said, you want my honest answer, Bill? He says, yeah. I said, no way. No chance. No chance. She has no chance of being a bodybuilder. Then he takes out another photo. He puts it next to her. He says, what do you think of this woman? I said, wow. I said, her name was Dawn something. Or I can't remember the last name. But she was shredded. Little tiny hips, shredded. Muscular delts, everything.
Right.
She's great. I said, why are you putting them next to each other? He says, it's the same woman.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I forgot that. I'm telling you that before shot, you never would have met. How can her hips go from here to here?
Right. She, unbelievable.
It took her 8 years, but she did it. It's like the old cliche, persistence pays no matter what you do.
Yeah.
Persistence pays. Give yourself a chance. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, don't listen to, like Arnold says, don't listen to the naysayers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Arnold, well, I myself told him not to be an actor, so I'm not a good fan. You know, so, but I'm saying, you know, just do what you want to do. That's my
point. You know? Remember when Robert Kennedy and Muscle Mag used to have before and after, and he used to always put pictures of the bodybuilding, you know, famous bodybuilders when they first started and their after pictures? Yeah. One of the crazy ones was Samir Banoot. He had a picture of him when he was in Lebanon. I swear to God, his knees looked bigger than his thighs.
Right.
In the beginning. Like, you would never think this guy would be Mr. Olympia one day. Never.
I saw those photos. Samir himself showed me some of those early photos.
Yeah.
And I can't believe, Samir, the amount of muscle you developed. One of them was a back shot. You know, remember Samir.
Yeah,
no
great dog
the fact that Samir. And in fact, that could have been one of the iconic photos.
Yeah.
Samir's blown back shot when he won the, was it the
83
Olympia, doing the double. Definitely one of the iconic photos of bodybuilding. Samir had muscle on every bit of his back, had definition of muscle.
Yeah.
He won that same shot when he was a young boy. No muscle there at all. Nothing. No lats. no separation, nothing.
Yeah.
And he gets up that back. So, like I say,
you never know.
Yeah. You can never know, you know?
Hey, I want to ask you a question about, you were talking about the rib cage, and I agree with you. I think absolutely, if you do it younger, it'll increase in size. When I started training at 14, I was training at home for like the first 2 years, and I had one of those pull-up bars where you screw it into the doorway. And I would do it, and I remember my elbows would always hit the door frame, you know. And I was reading in Muscle Builder, like Arnold and Robbie, they all did wide grip chins at Gold's Gym. So I told my dad was a forklift driver on the trucking docks, on the trucking terminals. So he'd work all day, you know, and stuff. So I told him, I said, you think we could get a wider bar, you know, because I want to do wide grip chin-ups like all the guys in the magazines. So my dad, what a great guy. He comes home one day with a pipe. So he measures the hallway. We had the closet and the bedroom door on each side. So there was a door frame on each side. So he measures the pipe. He measures the distance and how long the pipe has to be. And he cuts the pipe. So we fit it into the door frame. And then he even put like little washers on it or something so it wouldn't roll. So it would just stay there. Yeah. So I'm 14 years old and I'm doing wide grip chin-ups on this pipe. Yeah. And eventually I got to a point where I could put a 25-pound plate in between the towel and hold it in between my knees, you know, because I didn't have the belt. So I would do chin-ups like this and I became really good at them. And I always had wide shoulders. And I wondered if by doing those at 14 years old, if my shoulder structure got wider, you know, like my rib cage got bigger, you know?
Absolutely. Same principle holds.
Yeah.
Remember, at that age, you have flexible cartilage.
Yeah.
Even your bones are somewhat flexible. By doing that position, you actually, because I did the same thing. I mean, not so much, I used to have pretty broad shoulders too. I got it the same way you did. Wide chins and stuff like that when I was very young. I remember going, even before I lifted weights, I went to a park and did chins and dips before I even lifted weights.
Right.
I did for a year. I got up to where I could do like 50 chins with my wife. And I did that. I didn't know what I was doing. I was doing it every day.
Yeah.
Chins every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a photo of me taking a 13. And the thing I remember about it is I had unusually wide shoulders for a kid that age.
Yeah, yeah.
From my father, nobody had wide shoulders.
Right.
And from doing the chins. To answer your question, definitely.
So wow. If a kid, that's crazy.
Again, it's the same principle. If a kid's starting out, you know, and does, let's say, a little wider grip, they will probably give themselves wider shoulders if they start young enough. Yeah. Mm. Now, interestingly enough, though, I have to be honest, is that wide grip is not the best way to work the lats, though. The best way to work the lats, they've shown, is actually a shoulder width grip, like this.
Okay.
Hello. The wider you go, the less lat you work. I know it sounds weird, but that's...
You're not getting the full range of motion?
Right. It has to do with the range of motion.
Yeah.
When you do, let's say, a shoulder width grip, there's a much greater range of motion. You wind up working the lats more. And the funny thing is, and this is the irony of it, you get wider lats doing a, let's say, a shoulder width grip than you would a wider grip.
Hmm.
Arthur Jones used to point that out. That was one of the things he talked about all the time.
Yeah, I remember Mike Mentor used to say that too.
The fallacy of doing wide grip pull downs and wide grip. You get less range of motion. And you can see it. If you see two people, go to the gym one time and watch a person do wide grip, then do a jump. You'll see the person doing the shoulder width. It's a much greater range of motion.
Yeah.
The greater range of motion, two things happen. You work more muscle and more time under tension because of the greater range of motion. It equals greater muscle hypertrophy. And because it's meant by a greater muscle hypertrophy, you wind up getting wider lats.
Right, right.
Like the way I'm doing rows now. Oh, that's another thing. Like I say, I have to be innovative. I don't have a lot of equipment at my disposal right now because of the sports. So I went back to an exercise I haven't done in 30 years, another one, bent over barbell rows.
Yeah, I still do that.
I'm always afraid to do that exercise because when I last did it, I was still strong enough to lift heavy weight. I was using an average of 225 to 250 when I did it, and I kept on pulling my lower back out. I said, that's it. I'm never doing these again, and I stopped doing it. Now – what I do is I'm not using that kind of weight, trust me. But what I'm doing is I'm very careful. I make sure that my back is in the right position. I keep my legs bent. But when I bring up the bar, I'm using the shoulder width grip like this.
Okay.
And I'm keeping my arms at a slightly 45-degree angle, and I'm bringing it right to the stomach, right? And I'll tell you, that's a fantastic lat exercise.
It is great.
One set pumps my lats up like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, holy shit, I really like this exercise. Because that's a, you know, I really like it. I said, I can't believe I haven't been doing this all these years. Really, and I, the funny thing is, I have two discs out right now as we speak.
Wow.
As long as I don't, you know, try and lift heavy weight, you know, and keep my legs bent and always keep my back a little contracted. Don't round my back in a little. You don't want to use that banana back because that would be disastrous for a guy like me with my lower back. As long as you do that, there's hardly any tension on the lower back. I don't even feel anything, but my sure as hell feel it on my lats. And what I'm doing is the same thing. I'm aiming for 12 to 15 reps. I did four sets. I was able to get, I think I got 15 on the first, 12 on the second. I was only resting like 30 seconds between the set. The third, I got 10. By the fourth set, I was barely able to get 9 reps.
Yeah.
I was literally going to, just what I said earlier, I was going to near failure. Because when I did that last rep, I was going like this. I could barely get, but I tried to get up. That was near failure.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, four sets, I could have stopped there.
Right. That could have been your old back workout.
I'm serious. I felt that pumped. I mean, I could feel it. Yeah. As it is, they had a lat pull down machine, so I did the lat pull down. Same deal, you know, with the grip, you know.
The barbell rows is another exercise that not many young guys do anymore.
Oh, what a great exercise! I know. You know, I've been telling people. Yet I've been writing in my newsletter. I talk about the basics. I always include bent over barbell row.
Me too.
I feel a little hypocritical writing that since I don't do it. But the reason I don't do it again is because I was afraid of my lower back.
Right.
But the thing is, I really think it's a great, if you do right and you know, do proper form. Now, look, John, like if you could lift heavy weights, I can.
Yeah.
But, you know, like if you could do 225 or more and you could do the right form, fantastic. What I'm saying is I don't like the guys that do this stuff.
Right.
You know, where they do this, you know, they're not, you know, when I was doing it, John, I was doing it like very steady motion.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, a shoulder width grip, 45-degree. I was going like, this is my move.
Right.
I was going like this.
Right.
Very slow. No jerking at all.
Yeah.
If you do that, believe me, your lats are going to feel
I know, it. Right. What I see these young guys is they're usually standing up too high, and they're pulling it in to their, like, their hips.
No, wrong.
So their elbows are way here. They're doing it way wrong. Like, they're not activating their lats at all.
There's two ways to do it. Now I did two sets where I brought it to my stomach, let's say right above my belly button, right navel, and then I think I did one or two sets just to get a little more upper back. I brought it to my pecs.
Right.
If you do that, you get the whole freaking back.
I know.
You get the whole back. Now let's say to me, and I do occasionally do this right now also. Let's say, well, I want to get a little bit more lower lat. What do I do? You do a reverse grip row. You ever do that? Remember that was kind of Reg Park and Dorian Yates.
Yeah.
You do a first grip row. You keep again shoulder width grip, and this one you bring up to your waistline.
Yeah, because your elbows are so far back. Yeah.
Right. You do that, and that's an incredible lower lat exercise.
Yeah.
Grip, but it's actually really hard. It's harder than the regular row.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why, but I find it more difficult than the regular minimum barbell row.
Right.
Maybe it's because it involves more balance or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, I find it more difficult than the regular standard bent over barbell row.
Yeah.
Great exercise. Anybody who wants to have a really good back should really consider.
And I think that's one of the real basics, and there's so many young guys out there that don't do them at all.
Yeah. In fact, I'm so impressed. Like I say, I'm doing it now because I have no choice. I don't have a wide range of equipment available.
Yeah.
But I'm so impressed by the way it feels. And when I go back to the gym, I'm going to still do bent over barbell rows
because
I really got to like them all over again.
Right.
Last time I did that was like 35 years ago.
Wow, really? That long? Wow.
I feel like a guy who like met his old girlfriend who has to see him right. And fell in love. All
right. You're rediscovering your love for it again. Yeah.
Discovering, right.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right, Jerry. Well, I'll let you go because I know we talked for a couple hours, but. I hope you stay safe during this coronavirus and.
Before we go, are you when you go in public? Do you wear a mask and stuff like that?
Well, I work at the hospital. I work I do security.
Oh.
So we have to wear the mask there.
You have to wear the mask.
Yeah.
And you wear gloves too.
No, just the mask. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And now you're in, are you in Jacksonville, is it?
Tampa.
Tampa. Now, when you walk around or drive around, are most of the people there still walking? Are they wearing masks and observing the social distancing from what you can see?
Yeah, I went to the Whole Foods today after work, and I would say at least half of the people had masks on. More than half, yeah.
Are they keeping away from each other like they're supposed to, or did you notice?
Pretty much, yeah. It seemed like it. Okay. I walked around a corner, and there's some girls coming. She's like, oh, she's not like this. As I got too close to her, you know. Yeah.
I have a thing where I walk my dog down the street and people come towards me on the sidewalk, they literally run in the street. It's right. Hilarious to see. You know I mean? Right. If you didn't know what they were looking at, you'd think it was like Godzilla coming towards them.
Yeah.
Their eyes get wide and they run in the street. It's hilarious to see them. A lot of times I'm not wearing a mask because I'm just by myself.
Right.
But you know, the reason I ask you that is because, you know, they're opening up some cities now, you know, getting rid of the and I see here in L.A., people are already relaxing. It kind of makes me nervous.
Yeah.
A lot of people are not wearing the mask, although stores require you to wear a mask or they won't let you in. But I'm saying they're walking around and they're getting more importantly, they're getting way too close to each other.
Yeah.
And I find that very alarming because I think it could start a second wave of this. That's why I asked you. I was just curious.
Yeah.
I'm just a little concerned about this, you know?
It's funny. I just posted a video on YouTube. I did a guest posing. This was back in 87.
Yeah.
And it was like a week after a contest. So I was, they had me judge the contest too. And then they had me hand out the trophies. So, you know, back then we only had men's bodybuilding and women's bodybuilding. So I'm watching this video and I'm handing out the trophies to the women's classes. Every girl I kissed them on the cheek or I kissed them on the lips. Can you imagine that today? They won't even shake your hand now. I mean, you'd have to set the trophy 6 feet away and back away. You know?
Well, listen, John. Even worse than that, you would be accused of sexual harassment.
If you
kiss them on the cheek or the lips, you would actually be accused. Oh, that John Hansen, he's like Trump.
He's a predator.
He's a predator, you know? It's funny how times have changed, isn't it?
Oh, my God, it was unbelievable. I'm watching this thing, I'm like, every single girl, it was like normal. I mean, that's what they did. You know, you kissed them on the lips or you kissed them on the cheek.
That's the way it was back then, you know? I mean, everybody, if I meet sometimes female friends, you know, they give me a hug. I don't know whether I should kiss them. I used to kiss them on the cheek, but I'm afraid to now. Am I going past the line?
Right.
You know, you don't know what to do anymore. What are you going to do, you know?
Yeah, I remember there was this girl from the gym when I first moved here to Tampa. She was dating a guy, and every guy, you know, she knew when she saw him out, she'd kiss him on the lips.
Yeah.
And I was like, that freaked me out at first, but I kind of like that. You know, I was like, reminds me of the 70s.
real fast, I told you the story of the female body from New Jersey. Did I tell you that one?
No.
She was popular years ago. Her name was right at the tip of my tongue. She was from New Jersey. She was a national competitor. You know, when I was working for Joe, I interviewed her in the Marina Pacific Hotel.
Uh-huh.
Tech, her name was Janet Tech. Do you remember
Janet?
Oh,
yeah, I remember her. Yeah.
This Janet Tech, I was. And I was interviewing her. Now I was always very professional when I interviewed female bodybuilders. Never came on, never flirted. I treated them just like men.
Right.
No matter what they look like, just like men. But in her case, we kind of like hit it off. And I remember after I interviewed her, I said, you know, don't take this personally. And I know you're a married woman because you mentioned that, you know, but if you weren't married, I'd love to go out with you. I said, I find you very attractive and very sweet. And she said, I really appreciate that. You know, so when I left, she gave me a little kiss. Right. And so after that, at every contest, I saw her and she was very attractive.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And her husband was a nice guy. I think if I remember, he was a pharmacist. Every contest she'd see me at, she'd run over, give me a hug and kiss me on the lips.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm standing at a contest. It was in South Carolina. I think it was the USA. And I was standing talking to Aaron Baker, right? And I saw Janet Tech walk in with her husband. So I said to Aaron Baker, I said, hey, Aaron, see, that's Janet Tech. He says, yeah, I know. I said, she really likes me. As soon as she sees me, she's going to come across the room and plant a big kiss on me. Watch. Sure enough, she spots me. Jerry, she walks across the room. Hugs me, husband. I shake hands with her. Standing with, she gives me a big kiss on the lips.
Right.
We chat for a minute. She walks away, right?
Right.
And Aaron says, "Hey, I guess you were right, huh?" So I continue to talk to Aaron. But as I'm talking to Aaron, I'm looking over her shoulder. John, she went over and kissed and hugged about 25 other guys. And I pointed it to Aaron, so Aaron said, I guess you're not so special after
all. I remember being at the 1977 Mr. Olympia in Columbus, the one that Zane won for the first time. And that was the year that Arnold's book came out, Education of a Bodybuilder.
Yeah.
So after the prejudging was over, remember they had no expo back then. They just had, it was just a Veterans Memorial, that was it. Yeah. So Arnold made an announcement after the prejudging ended. He said, hey, guys, I don't know if you bought my new book, Educational Bodybuilder. I'm going to be out in the lobby signing copies.
Yeah.
So I go out in the lobby, and people start congregating, right? And they had one little table, and Arnold comes out, and I don't know if he was standing on a table, or he was standing on maybe a chair or something, or just behind the table, and he's signing autograph. I got my book autographed. And he was kissing all these girls on the mouth, you know, signing their shirts and stuff, you know.
He was kissing them on the mouth.
All of them, yeah.
It was just a regular. He didn't actually do a French kiss or anything.
No. But I mean, it was just like a standard way of greeting somebody, I guess. You know, it was just.
It was back then. I mean, today that's, I guess, kind of taboo unless you really are either involved with a woman or you know her that well. You know, it's considered politically correct to do that.
Yeah,
you can't even look at women a certain way.
I know.
I mean, if you look at a woman a certain way, I mean, she could, you know, she looks at you like you're some sort of predator.
Right.
I mean, you can't, I mean, they'll walk around with the skimpiest clothes on, but God help you if they catch you looking.
Right.
And you stand there and you scratch your head and say, now, wait a minute, they get mad that I'm looking, and I'm not glaring, I'll just look, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not doing like one of these, you know?
Right.
I'm just looking, and, you know, and they give you this dirty look like, you weirdo, go back in the corner or something.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, let me get this straight. They're walking around with these sexy outfits, but they don't want anyone to look at them. What am I missing you?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
I mean, this video is from 87, so that's, what, 33 years ago, so... But I was looking at it with a bit of nostalgia. I was like, wow, things used to be so fun back then, you know? And now it's like, I'm glad I was young back then. I got to enjoy those days. And, you know, maybe it'll never be like that again. It doesn't seem like it ever will be like that again.
Well, I miss that too, to be honest. I mean, right now with this pandemic going around, it's not a good idea to kiss people or even shake hands with guys, you know?
Well, I wonder when this ends.
Yeah,
are we going to go back? I mean, I don't think people are going to shake hands anymore.
I heard that. I heard from that word. It's going to be like this, you know, this thing or this.
Yeah.
It'll be, which is okay. But, there was something about, you know, the kissing stuff. I thought it was kind of sweet, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
I
mean, me too, yeah.
And I'm not sure that, again, other than women that know you very well or you know very well or you're involved with, it's now, unfortunately, a thing of the past. It's not considered proper to do that. And it kind of, I'm a little nostalgic for that myself. You know, I understand what you're saying. It kind of bothers me a little bit, but what are you going to do? That's the way things change.
Right.
All I can say is the young people today don't know what they missed.
No.
They'll never experience what you and I, you know, experienced.
So they missed out on the bodybuilding magazines. They missed out on the good gym atmosphere. And now they're missing out on the kissing and the hugging.
To be honest with you, I almost feel sorry for them.
I do too.
They have no idea what
they got. The computers, but they don't have the fun we used to have, you know.
I'd rather have the fun than the computers. But that's me, you know.
No, I know. Well, at least we got a chance to enjoy it at one time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Hey, John, how much of this interview are you going to put up at the beginning or just going to go when we?
Yeah, I think I'll put it at the beginning. I think people enjoy it.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was fun, a fun conversation. So I was going to suggest that.
I think I'll make two parts.
Yeah. I think there was
you gave some good information about training at home and stuff, you know.
Yeah, and the stuff about, you know, the rip cage, that's useful information.
Oh, absolutely. I'm putting all that in for sure.
I mean, like young guys, a lot of them don't know that. So,
no,
you know,
I know.
If they're, let's say, teenagers and they hear that, they could still have a chance to make a big difference in their shoulder width, their rib box thickness. So, you know, it's very useful for that because I don't see this written anywhere.
No.
I don't see it talking about
there's
it.
There's no magazines anymore, right?
Well, and even in the videos, nobody ever mentions this stuff.
No.
You know, I mean, so I think it's kind of uncommon knowledge that these people should know.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to mention your Applied Metabolics newsletter, Jerry, that you can get that on appliedmetabolics.com, right?
Applied Metabolics, yeah, it's still 30 to 50 pages. Did I say, no, actually about 35 to 50 pages.
Okay.
Every month, no ads. In fact, today I'm going to be writing an article that I know you would be interested. Listen to this. You're going to like this one. I'm going to do an article today for the newsletter. Just an example. I'm going to do an article. You know how for years, I'm sure you've been told this. When you train calves, you do one set with your toes out, one set with your toes in, and one set with your toes straight. We've heard that for years. I'm going to write an article today. They've done some recent science studies to test out whether that actually does work different parts of the calf.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to be writing an article of that. So you see, this is what I mean by practical information.
Right.
Plus, now you'll know, should I move my feet around when I do it, or does it make a difference, or what? You know?
Right, right.
So that's the kind of stuff I write. In other words, I write stuff that's really practical and useful on nutrition. I'm not involved with any supplement company. I can tell the truth. I'm not out to hurt any supplement company.
Right, right.
I just tell the truth about it as known by science. In other words, I say, this is what science says about this supplement. That's what I write. I don't give my own opinion or anything like that. So I think, and I talk about women's health and fitness. I have articles about, this is another one that women would be very interested. Tell me if women won't be interested in this one. I'm going to be doing an article talking about why young women gain weight fast. Hmm. What are the factors that make young women gain weight fast? You tell me what young woman on the face of this earth
would be interested in that. Right.
It's not bodybuilding. There'll be some bodybuilding involved because I'm going to give a couple of examples of how to avoid that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying my point is I have a very broad range of topics, and I think anybody would be interested. It's very inexpensive. Like I say, if they subscribe, they get an invitation to join my private Facebook page.
Okay. Where
they can, I put new studies on there every day. They can send me questions, short questions. This all goes with the subscription.
Okay.
So, again, I think it's definitely worth it. Because you know how long I've been around, John. There's something called knowledge, which is great. A lot of people have knowledge, but there's also something called experience, which doesn't necessarily go with knowledge.
Right.
I have both.
Right.
In other words, I have all the experience to tell people what works, what doesn't, and I can give the mechanisms for those who want to go more in depth, like I am, like you are. I will go in more depth and explain why.
Yeah.
Like we did with Rip Gage and when you asked me about the ribcage and the shoulders.
Yeah.
So they'll get the information. So it's www.appliedmetabolics.com.
Are sales going good, Jerry?
Well, I've been hit, like a lot of other people, I've been hit a little bit by this. I've gotten a couple of cancellations. I never ask why, but I noticed that the cancellations, it's kind of eased off now, but for about 3 weeks when this first started, it was like coming in really bad. It had me worried. I was getting like two or three cancellations a day out of nowhere.
Wow.
And it all started when
panicking.
So I'm thinking maybe it was people that, couldn't get to work, were afraid of money, because a lot of people, apparently they're really hurting because
they're not getting.
So I don't take any of that personally. I understand that. But other than that, I'm doing okay. I'm holding my own, I'm always trying to, like I say, I have so many fantastic things to write about that. If I stepped outside myself, and I looked at what's in this newsletter, I swear to God, I would subscribe myself because I don't see this stuff anywhere.
Right.
But I don't see it on websites. I don't see it in videos. It's really unique stuff. And again, the only thing I'd warn people about, and I do say this in my own videos, is it's not for the short attention span.
Yeah.
If you're overwhelmed by 40 to 50 pages – and you can't get past one paragraph, it might be a little bit too much for you.
Because
I do go to depth. On the other hand, there's no law that says you have to read the whole thing at once.
Right.
When I first started the newsletter, I had it designed so it could be read on anything, on a phone, on a computer, on an iPad. You read a little bit. You can have the articles read back to you for crying out loud by the artificial intelligence board. I mean, you can take it in your car. So this, that thing about, I don't have time to read it. Some people, that's nonsense. I don't buy that one.
Right.
That's ridiculous,
Right,
I mean,
right.
When I read books, I don't sit down and read the entire book, although I have.
Yeah.
I have, but I very rarely do. I read it in chunks.
Right.
I mean, a chapter or two. That's the way you do it.
Right.
What I mean?
Right.
Besides which, you retain more information when you do it like that.
Yeah.
If you think about it, try and read an entire book and then compare that to reading a little bit. See which one you retain more information. Right. I guarantee it, it'll be the chunks of information. That's the way the human brain works.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. All right, Jerry. Well, I wish you the best with that. I know I said I was going to subscribe. I'm going to subscribe now.
I appreciate that, John.
It's the least I can do for all the times you appear on my show.
I appreciate it. Hey, you know, if you ever know, if you're in the gym or anywhere, do me a favor. If anyone ever wants, is mentioning, do you know a good source of information about nutrition, exercise? Just tell them my website. If that comes out, I appreciate that too. Because it's all word of mouth. I don't do any advertising.
Yeah.
Other than I mention it in my videos. That's it. And you're nice enough to allow me to mention. That's it. This is my advertising.
All right. All right, Jerry. Well, it was great talking to you again. Stay safe during this time, and hopefully we can talk to you again soon, because you're always my favorite guest, so I hope to have you on again soon.
Sounds good, John. Great to see and talk to you, too. You stay safe, too, my friend.
All right. Take care, Jerry.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Jerry Branum for joining us. Be sure to check out Jerry's newsletter at appliedmetabolics.com. It's only $10 a month. And you get like a 45 to 50 page newsletter every month. And I know he puts a lot into that, and his knowledge is unparalleled. So let's support Jerry. And I also want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring the show. I want to thank our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in helping out the podcast and want to contribute to the Patreon account that we have on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website, just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com. It's in the upper right-hand corner, and click on that. You can contribute as little as $5 a month if you like, just to help pay the expenses of the podcast, and I appreciate that. All right, before we end, I do want to read this excerpt from Pumping Iron, which was the revised edition that came out after the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And Charles Gaines starts off here in this part I'm going to read. At the end of the professional Mr. Universe contest, which was the IFBB Mr. Universe, which was held after the Mr. Olympia. And if you remember, Arnold and Jim Lorimer were the promoters of the professional Mr. Universe because they did not hold the Olympia that year. The Olympia, of course, was in Australia. But Arnold, before he announced that he was going in the contest, or before he did go in the contest, he had announced that they were going to have the current Mr. Olympia from 1980 pose at his professional Mr. Universe contest. And of course, Arnold was the winner, but he did not pose. So Charles starts off and he says, "The real end was more ghostly still. The whole audience chanting for Arnold, drowning out his thanking it for coming. Most of the people in it thunderously wanting him, bodybuilding's greatest and most stirring ghost, its most arrogant and puckish ghost, to strip off his clothes and pose. Others wanting his head. They wanted those different things, members of the two factions in the audience of the Pro Mr. Universe show, for the same reason. Because a few weeks before, in the Sydney, Australia Opera House, Arnold had won his seventh Mr. Olympia title. It was not a simple victory. In fact, it caused at the time and for months afterwards an incredible uproar, reminiscent of the old chaos days of bodybuilding. It caused a still reverberating shakeup in international judging procedures, a near fistfight between Arnold and Mike Mentzer, and the threatened retirement of some of bodybuilding's top competitors, among them Mentzer, Boyer Coe, and Frank Zane, each of whom thought he should have won the Olympia title himself and was positive that Arnold should not have. And most disturbingly, maybe, it caused Arnold, who is bodybuilding for most of the world, to be booed by a crowd there in Sydney for the first time in his career. George Butler was in Sydney. I was not, but I've seen the pictures and I talked to a lot of people about it, and I have a pretty good idea about how things went. Early on, the competition seemed to be shaping up to be one of the best in bodybuilding history. Frank Zane, the defending champion, Mike Mentzer, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, and Dennis Tinerino were all in top shape. Tinerino claimed to be in the best shape of his life. Coe came in for the first time in his career weighing more than 200 pounds, and all of his muscle was very close to the skin. Dickerson, hot off his string of wins on the Grand Prix, was polished and tighter than ever, and Frank Zane, despite an injury suffered during training, could not have been more defined. Mike Mentzer figured that he had the best chance of all. He had scored a perfect 300 at this contest the year before. He had trained brutally hard for nearly 6 months for this year's contest and had added 10 pounds of cut muscle. There was no way, Mentzer thought, he could lose this year. Yet he did, as did the others, and none of them liked it. When he learned that he had won second place, Chris Dickerson said, "Oh, no," and disappeared into the Australian night. Frank Zane smashed his third-place trophy on the asphalt of the Opera House parking lot. Hoyer Coe, who took fourth place, reportedly asked out loud if there was no justice and then sent chairs flying into walls. And Mike Mentzer was quoted as saying about his placing fifth, "I'll tell you, somebody out there wanted me crushed out completely. Well, that's it for me. That's the last time I'm going through that kind of training for that kind of shit decision. Bodybuilding just lost what could have been its best spokesman." Why all the temper and sour grapes, you might wonder? They did, after all, lose to Arnold, and there's nothing unusual about that. Well, for one thing, because very few people who were there, other than the judges and Franco Colombo and Arnold himself, thought Arnold was in good enough shape to win. Most of the 15 competitors in the contest thought he shouldn't have won. The booers and the Opera House audience thought he shouldn't have won. And for another thing, Coe and Zane and Mentzer and Tinarino and others felt that not only unfairly beaten, but used and had by Arnold. His victory, they felt, denigrated them and cheapened the sport. That line of feeling runs something like this. Here was Arnold, retired now for 5 years, rich and famous and out of competitive bodybuilding, and all of a sudden, for no good reason, he decides to get back into it, only he doesn't tell anyone. He trains for only 7 weeks, which is an afternoon compared to what most of the others put in, and tells anyone who asks that he is training for a part in a movie he's about to make. And then he comes over to Sydney, where he's supposed to do color commentary on the contest for CBS, but instead, once he's there, once they're all there and it's too late for anyone to back out, he announces that he thinks he might as well compete. I mean, he's already won the title 6 times, and he sure as hell doesn't need the money or the fame, but as long as he's here. So he hops into a contest full of guys who would kill to win it just once, 5 of the 7 judges of which are good friends of his, and he wins the thing. At the end of that line of feeling is this question. What does all that say about how Arnold feels about us, the competitors who follow and in some cases emulate him, and about bodybuilding itself? The thing we still do with all 4 feet. It was that question, really, and the insult that seemed to be the only answer to it that caused all the furor over Sydney. It's a good question, but it misses the point. The fact is that Arnold does think of bodybuilding as his personal province, into which he can step back as sovereign whenever he wants, and he doesn't think much of the other competitors in Sydney. He sees them as technicians, vying and squabbling among themselves for empty dominance over an era in bodybuilding that is temporarily without giants. If Franco and Sergio Oliva and Lou Ferrigno and Dave Draper and I would suddenly all go back into competition now, he says, we would still rule everything. There are eras of certain people that come up that are great, and in between everything, it's just technical. It happens in politics. If you look at today, there are no Churchills around, nobody to really move people and make them believe in one thing, and therefore politics is just technical now. It's the same in bodybuilding. There are no giants around, and it's become a technical sport where everybody's talking about Chris Dickerson and did you see Frank Zane's lower left abdominal, that sort of thing. It's also a fact that he enjoyed beating the technicians, a couple of whom had been guilty of sniping at his training principles, and that anticipation of that enjoyment was a part of his decision to compete. I wanted to have a good time with the whole thing, to go there, see them all be surprised, see them freak out and have diarrhea, you know? And be confused and be upset about it and have a career that they had planned for themselves to go down the tube in 2 seconds. And I accomplished that. People are retiring now. Hoyer Coe wants to retire. Mike Mentzer wants to retire. Everybody wants to retire now because of this event. The only thing that means is that now I have to expand my next book. I have to add a chapter on how to make your competition retire. But it was not the whole decision or even the biggest part of it. The thing that confused and angered so many people about Arnold's return to competition was that they couldn't figure it. They couldn't locate it in any logic. He had everything to lose and only $20,000, which he didn't need, to win. So why? A lot of theories were ventured, that he was doing it to perk up his movie career or to help sell his books or because someone had implied that he couldn't win again or because he missed the limelight. But none of those theories really seemed sufficient. It seemed finally, to a lot of people, a kind of crazy thing to do. As crazy as Muhammad Ali's comeback fight against Larry Holmes, which was broadcast in Sydney the day before the Mr. Olympia contest. But Arnold's return wasn't crazy, only odd, and the only odd against the glad-handing, anxiously cooperative, buck-turning backdrop of bodybuilding in 1980. Like Muhammad Ali, Arnold doesn't play anybody's game but his own. And also like Ali, he is a brilliant hunch player. He operates on every level of his personality without needing reasons. For better or worse, he returned to competition because he happened to be training anyway for a part in a movie, and he felt like it, because some unquestioned impulse in his gut told him to. After having studied hundreds of pictures of the contest, it looks to me like he should have won. He himself acknowledges that he only was 80 to 90% of his overall shape of 1975, and that his legs were weak, but his arms and back and chest were there, and in the pictures he looks, even at 80 to 90%, to have more symmetry and flow to his body than anyone else. I wasn't there, and no matter how many pictures I look at, I won't ever really know how the physiques compared, but I do know why Arnold won. He won because he's a great competitor, exactly as he says he is. Arnold is a giant. He won because of that, and he should have. The point missed by the competitors who felt cheapened and belittled and insulted by Arnold's victory is this. It is giants, and only giants, who carry bodybuilding forward, and every victory for them is a victory for the art and sport. Franco Colombo is another giant, albeit a short one. 8 years ago, when I first started to write on bodybuilding, he and Arnold were the top of the heap, and they still are. Franco is bemused by what Arnold did in Sydney. He thinks he might just do the same thing next year when the Olympia contest will be held in Columbus. I went to see him recently in Los Angeles and to talk to him about that and other things. He was wearing a blue t-shirt that said Vitalis, the product that he's paid an annual salary to advertise on TV, and was pacing around the big empty new offices on Westwood Boulevard, into which the following day he was moving his profitable chiropractic and mail order businesses. Parked outside in the lot was his red Alfa Romeo. Franco prefers the word superstar to giant. Practically everybody now, he says, is a star in bodybuilding. All those guys with 3% body fat who win the Mr. America and Mr. Universe contest and who all look alike. But there have only been ever a few superstars. Namely, said Franco, John Grimmick, Steve Reeves, Reg Park, Sergio Oliva, Arnold, and Franco. And those few have prerogatives. Arnold won the Olympia this year just to show them he can do it. And I'm going to do it next year, maybe, because we want to show them that if we want, we keep the Olympia forever. I would like everybody to know that we might come back and win it any time. Franco came over to America at the end of 1969 with $1,000 in cash and very little English. Now, 11 years later, he's a TV personality on talk shows as well as in commercials, a bodybuilding superstar, and a wealthy man. He accomplished all that in the same way Arnold did, by refusing to take it easy on himself, and by extending himself variously to meet with what both of them perceive to be the endless possibilities in this country. Here in America, the opportunities are unlimited, but you have to do it yourself. In other words, over here, people say, look, you want it? Get it. That's why me and Arnold are successful here. It's because when we came, everybody was lying on the beach doing nothing. There was 100 bodybuilders lying out there doing nothing. So I said to Arnold, what the hell are we doing here? Why don't we go do something? And Arnold said, sure, let's get out of here. So we got jobs laying brick, and we train hard and win contests. Then we start writing books and making movies. Arnold went to business administration school, and I went to chiropractic college. And 6 years later, I've got a degree, and I go back out on the beach, and those same guys are still lying there. I say, huh? What are you waiting for? Christmas? Franco is still extending and loving every minute of it. After he wins the Olympia again, he'd like to do certain movies. Like, actually, I would like to do one very nice love movie, and the next one should be a very brutal one, totally the opposite. And he wouldn't mind serving in politics as sort of an advisor, to look around in the cities and see all the things wrong and report back to the city and say, I would like to see these things done this way and do this kind of changes. And he's going back to college again this summer to get a PhD in nutrition and prepare himself for the ultimate superstars extension. I want to get so involved in nutrition and know so much about the body that I can live much longer than normal. I think there's a possibility that we can live between 120 and 150 years. That's what I want to do. Franco took me back to his house later to watch tapes of his Vitalis commercials, which he says have boosted the company's sales to their highest point in 50 years. He's wonderful in them. Sly, disarming, pungent, and he watches them with pleasure and funny stories about their production. He looks exactly the same as he did in 1972, both on screen and in person. The joy and cuteness, the irrepressibility, haven't worn off or even down in his face. Watching him sell the hell out of hair oil on television, I asked him if he and Arnold were still close. Me and Arnold, we are very busy doing so many things. We travel in different directions, but he's my best friend and I'm his best friend. When he needs help, I help him. And when I need help, he helps me. And when we get together, we are the same. There's nothing changed. We get together. We go to the same places. We play like two kids. We play very hard. We go and play bowling. We play chess, and we don't even know how to play chess. Then we still drive the cars. We go up into the mountains and see how fast the cars go, you know? One time we almost fell over the hill, and that's important. The mind needs that. The Pump by Vitalis, adds the television Franco, holds and holds and holds and holds some more. The Pump by Vitalis. Franco's best friend lives in a $700,000 house on a quiet, expensive Palmline Street in Santa Monica. Outside the house in the driveway are a Mercedes and a doozied up Jeep Cherokee. Inside is a portrait of Arnold by Jamie Wythe, the photograph of him with Ted Kennedy, another with Jimmy Carter. The furniture, the paintings, the rugs, the books, everything in the house reflects Arnold's uncanny ability to grow in a variety of ways at once and to assimilate quality as quickly and efficiently as he does protein. I went by to see him at his new house a few days after I saw Franco. It was a perfect Southern California afternoon, and we sat outside by his black bottom swimming pool, his guest house, and hot tub jacuzzi behind us. Over a month had gone by since Sydney, and Arnold was leaving shortly for Spain to play Conan the Barbarian in a $15 million film of that name. He was expansive and relaxed, and we talked all afternoon. When I lit a cigar, he went and got a big Cuban number and lit up too. One of his two secretaries came by to check on a problem with the security alarm system. Late that afternoon, taking a jacuzzi before we went to dinner, he looked around his darkening property and said, "I love this new house. I like to think about myself like a snake. I rest up here like under a rock, save myself, grow strong, and then when I'm ready, I jump out and strike, make my move." Hoarding himself didn't occur to Arnold in 1972. I asked him what had changed in his life to make it necessary now. "Well, first of all, my life is much more hectic now than it was when we first met. Back then, all I had to be concerned with was to train, go to school, and take care of my mail order business. Now, of course, there's so many other things. I'm always working on a book, for instance. I'm always preparing for some film, taking sword fighting lessons, horseback riding lessons, voice lessons, to get rid of some of the bad pronunciations and all those things. The office now has so many responsibilities. I manage my money and real estate and produce shows, you know, with raising money and organizing and doing advertising and all those things. Which means I have to get up at 6:30 in the morning. I have to do my running and then go to the gym. So by 9 o'clock, I have my breakfast behind me and all my training's done. In the evening, I maybe take dance lessons or lessons on how to lift a woman or do the sword fighting for Conan and so on. And during the day, I do all the business, answering mail, phone calls for an hour or two in the morning. And then it's working on a book, picking photos for the book or setting up seminars or doing exhibitions in prisons. So now the whole day's occupied. The year's occupied now with 10 different things, which there were only 3 things before. I feel now that I'm a combination of a businessman, actor, producer of bodybuilding shows, and also, like this year, I was a competitor. So that's quite a bit going on. He looked out over the roofline of his house. Like Franco's, his face hasn't changed in 8 years. His hard, honest eyes are as avid as they were in 72. His grin is mischievous and open and quick. "I enjoy it, though. I feel that if I don't do something all the time, I'm wasting my life. I'm the most comfortable when I'm busy and when I do things and accomplish things. The point is to go somewhere, and that has been my life, working towards something and keeping things up." I asked him if he missed the old anonymity and the old gaiety and carelessness that anonymity afforded him. "Yeah, I miss it. I mean, you wish you could have 2 lives. Before 1975, when I wanted to light up a joint at a party, I lit it up because I didn't have national recognition. Now I can't do that anymore. I haven't had a joint in my hand since 1975. I haven't done anything to harm my career since 1975. But the reason why that doesn't annoy me is that I've always had to give things up all my life to achieve what I wanted." At 34 years old, he has already achieved much of what he set out from Graz, Austria, 12 years ago to achieve. He wanted to be the world's best bodybuilder, and he is. He wanted to be famous, and he is. He wanted to be rich, and he is that too. By his own definition, a millionaire who no longer has to think about money. Either directly or indirectly, he achieved all those things through bodybuilding, at which he worked as hard as anyone has ever worked at anything. That work combined with his splendid genes to make him a giant in bodybuilding. And as he proved in Sydney, he's still a giant there, though now a largely disaffected one. He believes that the sport and art of bodybuilding are overpopulated now with midget technicians and hustlers, in it only to make a buck instead of to locate the joy and pride he found there and to let the bucks take care of themselves. The goals he's always setting for himself lie outside of bodybuilding now. He is now, finally, after Sydney, bored and disillusioned with bodybuilding and ready to go to be a giant elsewhere. He thinks he might someday get into politics. Eventually, he wants a sturdy and fun-loving wife, children, a big home in the American West with high ceilings and simple rugged furniture, and land. In the meantime, he wants to be a giant in films. I think I could be and will be an heroic character. I'd like to do heroic films. I'd like to be like Clint Eastwood, someone who takes what they have and makes something out of it, not trying to change. I think I can go all the way in that and eventually get into producing because I like the business end of the things as much as just being always the talent. Arnold also wants to go on being an effective inspiration and model to as many people as possible. He wants to work with prisoners and retarded children. He wants to learn to ski better and play better tennis, to act better and read better books. Though he didn't mention it, he may well want real estate on the moon. Giants have big appetites. You never get where everything is done. You always have this new thing in front of you. So then you work towards that. So it's an everlasting hunger for new things, for achieving something else. More than anything else, Arnold says, he wants to stay hungry. And it is that word, more than any other, that still describes him. Back in 1968, he came to this country and picked up the art and sport of bodybuilding where the last giant had left them. Almost single-handedly, he carried them a long way to the present. Now he's put them down again and gone on to other things. It remains to be seen who will pick them up next and in what direction they will be carried. All right. Excellent writing, of course, by Charles Gaines from the book Pumping Iron. That's the revised edition that came out after the 1980 Mr. Olympia 40 years ago. Wow. Can't believe it. And it's amazing how all the things Arnold wanted to do, he did do. And it's kind of sad to hear about Franco, how he wanted to live so long. And he's, of course, passed away last year. All right, folks, that's it for the show. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week with an interview with the great Peter McGough, the former editor-in-chief of Flex Magazine. Peter's going to talk to us about his career at Flex Magazine, particularly in the early 1990s, when we had that great influx of talent in bodybuilding, Flex Wheeler, Kevin Lavroni, Paul Dillette, all those great bodybuilders that came out in the 1990s, and, of course, Dorian Yates as well, and Peter's experience writing for Joe Weider's magazine. So that'll be next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care of yourself, everybody, and we'll see you next week.